Some politicians are intent on slowly doing away with our public education system in favor of privatized education that is paid for with taxpayers' money. Voucher money largely flows to religious schools. Funding private and religious schools through vouchers is an end run around our constitutionally created public education system. The voucher school program needs elimination rather than expansion. So wrote Patrick Elliott in a recent opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Governor Scott Walker is proposing an expansion of the school choice program, particularly in Milwaukee and Racine. What can Wisconsin learn from research on school choice in New Orleans and Milwaukee? Two guest journalists who visited Madison to speak at a conference in March called Renewing Public Education in Wisconsin are joining us today to talk about the controversial topic of school choice. Sarah Carr has written about education for the last 12 years and has worked as staff writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and the New Orleans Times-Picayune. She is the author most recently of Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and America's Struggle to Educate Its Children, a nonfiction account of New Orleans schools. Also joining us is Barbara Miner, a reporter, writer, and editor for almost 40 years, who has written for publications ranging from the New York Times to the Milwaukee Journal. Her newest book is Lessons from the Heartland, a turbulent half-century of public education in an iconic American city called an explosive educational biography of her hometown, Milwaukee.
Welcome to University of the Air, Barbara. Sarah?
Welcome to you, too.
Happy to be here.
How far back does this whole controversy go? Does it go back to, what, school desegregation in 1954 or so? Give us some historical perspective on it.
Well, you are right, it does go way back. In fact, it goes back to, on some levels, segregated Jim Crow schools, because the first freedom of choice schools were actually in the South, and they were freedom of choice to send white kids to segregated academies. So there's been a fairly long history. And it was actually back in 1955 that Milton Friedman laid out the economic rationale for school vouchers. But those are the roots back in history, and there's many current topics to talk about. But you're right, it goes way back.
I would add that, you know, choice is kind of a complicated term. I think these days, particularly in Wisconsin, most people think of it in terms of charters and voucher schools. But it's also been used to refer to magnet programs and to voluntary desegregation programs. So depending on the context and the history of the community that you're in, school choice can mean very different things.
Well, let's take a look first at the problems that are out there. Presumably, we wouldn't be talking about vouchers and school choice if the public school system wasn't filled with certain problems that people see or a certain controversy. Can you take a look at the state of public school system and why is it that we have all this controversy about sending children away from it?
Wow, do we have about 5 years here? It's complicated. Let me try and narrow down the question a little bit because you did pack a lot into that question. And, you know, one of my concerns is how the term failing schools has been used politically. You know, because interestingly, before the mid-1990s, the term failing schools was all but non-existent. And it certainly was never applied to Jim Crow schools in the South that could not even afford desks. But after the election of George W. Bush and the bipartisan passage of NCLB, the failing schools label, it just exploded. And it was used to label schools and districts alike. Now, my kids went to public school, and I can lay out any number of critiques of public schools. But what I don't like is that in the name of so-called reform, schools have been labeled. And they've been labeled to punish, not necessarily to improve. And so you have this whole sort of failing schools label that's been applied to schools and districts alike, invariably urban schools, invariably schools with lots of poor kids and black kids and Latino kids. And what I say is there's a lot more going on than meets the eye.
So if we say failing schools, and you say, Barbara, that that means it's a reason or a rationale for punishment, what kind of punishment are we talking about? Just withholding federal funds?
In Milwaukee we have the clearest example in 1990 when they decided to put public tax dollars into private schools. I mean, in essence, I believe they abandoned the public schools, and they used the rhetoric of failing schools to help do that. Now, you know, as I said, there's any number of failing schools in the sense of schools that aren't working right. But we also have in Milwaukee, you know, I'm from Milwaukee, and people will kind of go like, ooh, you have all those really bad schools there in Milwaukee. And I also go, you know, did you know that on the U.S. News and World Report, we have the two top high schools in all of Wisconsin in their listing? And so, again, the label has been used, I think, for certain purposes that go beyond really trying to improve public education as a publicly controlled institution.
And where does this standard of failing come from, and what are its components, and are they consistent?
I mean, a lot of it comes from No Child Left Behind and this emphasis nationally on schools having to meet certain benchmarks defined largely by test scores.
Right.
And I think that's sort of one critique right. that's built into yeah. this whole idea of failing is that you shouldn't really define or you can't really define a school based on its test scores
These
alone.
These are standardized national tests?
States have their own standardized tests, and so they vary from state to state, and the bar varies depending on what state you're in. I mean, it's interesting. In New Orleans, it's pretty clear that when Katrina happened, by the test scores, that the system overall was performing pretty low. But you had sort of these two kind of narratives as to why. Sort of according to one narrative, the schools had been starved of resources for years, precipitated partly by desegregation when the middle class and white community left the schools en masse and virtually overnight. So there are those who argue that the system had really been set up to fail. And then there are others whose views really held sway in the wake of Katrina, who argued that the structure was unsound and that they needed a new public education structure. So you still see that tension kind of playing out in the debate in New Orleans today. Is it that the schools were starved of resource and were never allowed to succeed, or is it that we need a different education structure?
I would think, too, that anytime you look at the success of a school, you're also looking at what surrounds it in terms of the community and the resources and the poverty of that particular area, particularly with the way we use property taxes to support schools. Can you talk about the economics of the problems with schools?
Well, I can speak to Milwaukee very clearly, and what we have in Milwaukee is, in fact, the segregation is so intense in Milwaukee that we've actually had to coin a new term, hypersegregation. And so, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, there was a school desegregation struggle around segregated schools within the city of Milwaukee. But what we have, in essence, right now in the Milwaukee region is we have a school system in the city which is predominantly African American and Latino, and a suburban school system that's predominantly white. And so we have, in essence, really the same segregation, but it's on a regional rather than just a city level. And, you know, one of the jokes, you know, Sarah was talking about test scores, and I believe in standards. I believe in, you know, my kids took tests and I wanted to know how they were doing. But you can also see how test scores are misused. And there's this kind of joke. I was talking to a statistician, a professor, and he said, well, you know, it's the BMW effect. And I said, what? Excuse me? And he said, well, you know, you just go to the neighborhood and you look at how many BMWs are in the driveways, and I can pretty much tell you how those kids will do on those standardized tests.
Well, okay, now you're talking about segregation, even though it's not supposed to be occurring. And way back in the 50s, in some ways, same phenomenon as we have today, right? I mean, you had neighborhoods. You had neighborhoods that had more black kids in them and neighborhoods that had more white kids in them. And wasn't busing instituted to mix things up?
Well, it's interesting because in 1965, Martin Luther King came to Milwaukee. And it was about the time when there was what they called the freedom school struggles in Milwaukee against segregated schools. And it was fascinating going back and looking at the news clips from the time because, you know, King said, I support the freedom schools and I support the boycott to call attention to segregated schools. And then he said, and it was a very prescient comment, he said, but honesty compels me to note that the school problem will never be solved until we solve the housing problem. Mm. And I think that's something we have completely forgotten in this country.
Housing problem, by that you mean who is able to afford to live in certain places, the segregation of housing itself.
The hyper-segregation in the Milwaukee. Yeah. And it's mostly race, but it's also class. Poor people tend to live in Milwaukee. More affluent people live in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think you're right that the intent of busing was to mix things up. But not only did you have white and middle class flight, but you also had dynamics where in a lot of cities, poor and largely minority communities bore the brunt of busing, and sort of desegregation plans were designed to sort of, in a lot of cases, minimize the impact on middle class and white families. And it was the poor and minority families who might have to travel more than an hour on buses. And so among all sorts of communities of people, you had sort of a lot of skepticism about the way desegregation was carried out, even if they might have agreed with it in theory.
So was the whole thing, in a way, going back to the 1950s, to desegregation? Was it kind of misguided? Was it just too idealistic? Was it unrealistic?
Well, I believe Brown v. Board was right. And Brown v. Board held that separate and equal is unconstitutional. And it wasn't like it was unconstitutional because it was like this sort of, you know, axiom, but it was because over time they had found that separate led to unequal.
Right.
And you know, it's interesting because people don't talk about that. I mean, it's amazing in Milwaukee what we don't talk about. I mean, again, you know, race is at the heart of just about everything that happens in the city. And, you know, it's sort of like the air. It's ever present, but seemingly invisible, and we never talk about it. And, you know, and I think the whole desegregation struggle was very complicated. In Milwaukee, the proponent, when asked once, well, did desegregation fail? He said, well, it was never tried. So how could I say it failed? And there's some very important, and if we have time to go into some fascinating Supreme Court decisions, the one in 1974 out of Detroit, which in essence put a stop to Brown v. Board.
How so?
Well, in 1974, and Sarah, pipe in whenever you want, but there was a case in Detroit, and the judge had ordered desegregation, what was called inter-district desegregation. In other words, not just within Detroit, but between Detroit and the suburbs. And interestingly, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it really was, in a sense, the sort of the bookend of Brown v. Board. And I want to read this because it's actually a fascinating quote from Justice Thurgood Marshall, because it was a 5-4 decision, as of course many Supreme Court
most interesting ones.
That's when I say pay attention to presidential elections. Look at all the history of 5-4 decisions. But anyhow, there was a 5-4 decision where the Supreme Court basically said no, desegregation stops at the city boundaries. And as others have said, it was basically a blueprint for, you want to avoid desegregation, you go to the suburbs. So, but Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he, remember, was the person who had shepherded Brown through the courts, he issued a dissent that was unequivocal, it was eloquent, and he said, quote, in the short run, it may seem easier course to allow our great metropolitan areas to be divided up into two cities, one white, the other black. But it is a course, I predict, our people will ultimately regret. And it's hard to find anyone in a city today, Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, New York, Philadelphia, you name it, it goes on, who does not regret that decision.
So do we see something like vouchers as kind of an attempt to, again, kind of get around the whole desegregation thing, or is it some sort of a patch to somehow make the system work?
You know, I think it really depends on who you're talking to. I think that overall there has not been sort of at the national or state level much of a focus on desegregation for the last several decades, and that, you know, you did see a period in the 1970s and 1980s where there was a rise in magnet programs that were designed in some cases as desegregation efforts to attract kids from different backgrounds and neighborhoods to a common school. And you also saw sort of a growth or a small growth in voluntary desegregation programs like the Chapter 220 program in Milwaukee, where students from the city are able to go to the suburbs and vice versa. But the emphasis starting really in the early 90s has shifted off of magnet schools and voluntary desegregation programs and onto vouchers and charters.
And isn't the voucher in some case a chance for some families to get into parochial education. I think I've read columns that both of you have written about some of the fairly extreme examples of schools where people can take their children where all kinds of rather extreme and quite dangerous things are being taught.
Well, let me talk a little bit about vouchers because Milwaukee, our big educational claim to fame is that we have the country's oldest and largest voucher program. I went to Catholic schools. My parents believed in sending us to Catholic, a private school. And I think private schools have a very important role to play within, you know, an array of educational options. However, I don't think the public should be expected to support those private schools. And part of what upsets me about the voucher program in Milwaukee is a school can have every single one of its students in the voucher school paid for by a publicly funded voucher, and yet they still get to call that school private. So as a private school, they don't have to obey constitutional rights of due process so they can kick students out at will. Other things that we have fought for as a state to sort of hold up as ideals for our public schools. For example, Wisconsin has a very good student anti-discrimination law that public schools may not discriminate against students on the grounds of gender identity, sexuality, pregnancy, marital status. That does not hold in private schools. So we have all these rights that we fought for, special ed, protection of gay students, constitutional rights of due process, that by merely defining these voucher schools as private, they're out the door. I mean, that's crazy public policy.
And how much monitoring is there? I thought I had read in some of the things.
The standards they've risen some. When I covered schools in Milwaukee starting in 2002, and when I arrived, basically all you needed was a building occupancy permit and kids. And there were some nominal state standards, but really it amounted to a building occupancy permit and kids. But now, as Barbara says, there is an accreditation process.
For teachers, for curriculum?
No. Just for the school. I mean,
a school has to get approved by one of these entities that's empowered to grant it accreditation. And so that is a big shift. I did a series along with another reporter, which found that there was just an incredible range in the quality of the schools. Like in the public schools, there were some on the bottom end that were basically run by crooks who really had no business running schools. But there were other very top performing, stable, parochial and independent private schools in the program. And so I think it's sort of been an issue of debate since the program's inception is sort of how do you get the bottom tier out, and a lot of conflicting debates about sort of the extent to which the program should have government oversight and monitoring.
And so would you say that what would you say to, let's say, a low-income family in Milwaukee that felt that their children were sort of condemned to go to a school that was substandard in some way and they want a better chance, they want out? And they would see a voucher as that chance, whereas you would argue that it's taking tax dollars and putting it into private education. How would you meet the needs of that family that sort of wants to escape the destiny of where they happen to be living?
Well, one important thing is I never blame parents where they send their kids. I mean, life is hard, and parents do what parents are expected to do. They advocate for their child. I do, however, blame policymakers because they have a different responsibility, and it is their job to balance all these competing interests and to protect the rights of all children. Now, interestingly, there's been a marketing of voucher schools that really is not reality-based. That's probably the kindest thing I can say. And, for example, there was a 5-year study that finished about a year ago, and they found that of the students in the voucher schools that started, 5 years later, only 17% were still in the voucher schools. Now, exactly why they left, it's very unclear. We do know that a lot of voucher students are either out and out expelled or counseled out or asked to leave. And it's not that public school kids don't get disciplined and expelled and suspended. But the difference is the voucher schools, once they kick a kid out, they have no responsibility for what happens to that kid. And in fact, there was a study done this last fall of the number of students from middle of September to December 1st who left the privately run charters and the voucher schools in Milwaukee. It was almost 450 students who then were sent back to the Milwaukee Public Schools. And about a third of those were because they had special education needs. So, you know, parents were voting with their feet to leave the voucher schools. Just one other quick thing, because what Sarah said is really important in terms of there are very good voucher schools and there are very good public schools and there's very good charter schools. But what happened in Milwaukee is we were sold a promise that vouchers were, in essence, going to be the silver bullet that would lift up all boats. They didn't. And so what has been the response, unfortunately, however, was to expand vouchers across the state, even though in Milwaukee they've done no better than the public schools, even though they get to kick out kids, they don't have to deal with the special ed kids. And now we have what in essence is a policy that has never delivered on its promises, and we want to expand it?
Now tell me again, if you, in case you already have and I missed it, what was the rationale for saying that voucher schools would lift the level of education for all?
Oh, in Milwaukee in the early 1990s, it was what was wrong with the Milwaukee public schools was there wasn't enough competition, parents didn't have enough options and choices, and that the voucher schools would give children the chance to have opportunities that were unavailable in the private schools, and therefore this was the way to ensure educational opportunity for low-income black kids. That was pretty much how the program was sold.
Run that by me again. How would the voucher schools, which would be for people who could presumably afford to send their kids there?
No, vouchers are mean tested.
They're
targeted at low income.
They're targeted at low income.
Places.
Okay.
Yeah.
Originally, you had to be at 185% or lower of the poverty level. Now it's up to 300% of the poverty level. And Walker tried to, in his last budget in 2011, but didn't succeed in opening it up to anyone at any income level.
And these vouchers simply give the family the option of going to any school that they want to? Or how, like, let's say I live in Milwaukee and I get one of these vouchers. It allows me to do what with my children?
To go to a designated private voucher school.
Just a specific one, not any that
well,
I choose?
Well, there's 112 private voucher schools.
And I can choose then as a parent.
Correct.
Yeah. I think, you know, in asking your question sort of about what if you're a low-income family that doesn't have sort of options and sees this as a way out of a school that they don't want to send their kids to, I think there's been a tension sort of among voucher advocates. I think there are some who sort of implicit in that question view it as a social justice issue and believe that they should be targeted just at low-income families. And I think there are others, including the governor, who are just sort of in favor of much sort of broader wholesale privatization and would like vouchers to not be means tested. And so, for instance, Louisiana, where I live, now has a statewide voucher program, and that was a big issue of debate there. There were those who wanted to use them to solely to empower low-income families to have more school options, but there are others who wanted to just privatize the whole public education system.
We're going to look more at the schools in Louisiana as well as here in Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our two guests this hour are Sarah Carr and Barbara Miner. Both are educators and journalists talking about school choice, which is a very hot topic here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Before we go further, let's redefine those terms. We've been talking about voucher schools, charter schools. Sometimes you also hear about magnet schools. Mm-hmm. There's popular films out like Waiting for Superman. There's a lot of discussion of schools, but I'm not sure we've got our terms down. Can you tell us something about what the different terms
mean?
Well,
I'll do the voucher definition and I'll leave it to Sarah to do the charters. They're more complicated.
Sounds good.
So the vouchers in Wisconsin are pretty simple. They're private schools. And the voucher is a dollar amount that's given to a low income, although at this point it's up to 300% of the poverty level, given to pay the tuition at a private school. So the schools, by definition, are private schools, even if every single student receives a publicly funded voucher. So as a result, there's a whole different rules and regulations and laws governing public and private schools in Wisconsin.
I have a question then. So are all private schools voucher schools?
No.
Have to apply to be considered?
Every year in the spring, the Department of Public Instruction puts out a sort of notice that if you want to be considered a voucher school, in other words, eligible to receive publicly funded vouchers that will pay the tuition at your private school, you have to let the DPI know.
So why wouldn't any private school apply for that just to get the funding?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons. For example, first of all, originally, until Walker expanded it 2 years ago, voucher schools had to be in the city of Milwaukee. So a private school that wasn't in the city of Milwaukee couldn't even want to.
An important distinction.
Another important is the more elite private schools, they don't want the voucher kids because part of their whole sort of purpose is to be elite and to more tightly control their student body. And so at this point, actually, most of the voucher students, really, it's for religious school purposes. 85% of the students receiving vouchers in Wisconsin right now go to religious-based schools. And so it's really become fairly dominantly in Wisconsin a way for parents to get public dollars to send their kids to religious schools.
Well, let me ask a question about that. And I'm going to exaggerate just for purposes of discussion. But let's say my school is the school from the Church of the Planet Mars, and that the textbooks we use are teaching that the divine creator came from Mars, and et cetera, et cetera. What kind of oversight is there if there is public money toward vouchers that then children can be sent to where they are indoctrinated with something that is pretty far out?
That's been a big issue in Louisiana, which has it had a small voucher program in New Orleans, and it expanded it statewide this school year. And there was a lot of investigative reporting done showing that schools were going to be teaching creationism and just bad science. And the response of the officials there is that it will be caught on the back end in terms of the results, in that there is sort of the schools do have to participate in Louisiana in the state standardized testing system. And so eventually, if over time kids are not passing these tests at high enough levels, they'll be expelled from the program. And there's been a lot of debate about that, because you might have kids that are at these schools for 2 or 3 years that are teaching creationism before it gets really sorted out on the back end.
Well, and here in Wisconsin, there's absolutely nothing the DPI can do about that sort of curriculum in a religious school, because we have what is called the separation of church and state, where the government is not allowed to tell churches and religions what they can teach. So you can have a voucher school saying that if you use birth control, you'll go to hell. If you're not married and you have premarital sex, you can go to hell. So it's to me, there are the curricular issues of are they teaching good or bad science. But there's also fundamental issues that, in a democracy, people have the right to say how they want their public tax dollars spent in terms of what people are taught using their public tax dollars. And, I think it's a sign of kind of how outrageous things have gotten in Wisconsin. And I'm glad that in Louisiana they're talking about creationism. Because we know that there's schools in the Milwaukee voucher program that use textbooks that talk about creationism. But there's kind of been this, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil approach to whether we really want this as our public policy.
So it starts to sound like a don't ask, don't tell kind of thing. We'll give you the money, but just don't tell us what you're doing with it, because if you're doing something that's religious and that would therefore be unconstitutional because you're receiving government funds, we don't want to know.
The don't ask, don't tell applies. The other end of it is a little bit more complicated.
And is this the voucher program, say, here in Wisconsin, is it a huge budget in terms of the amount of tax dollars that are currently going into voucher schools?
Well, in Milwaukee right now, we have almost 25,000 students receiving publicly funded vouchers, which is almost the size of the Madison School District, which is the state's second largest district. It's a huge program.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's voucher schools. They're the ones that are private, and they have elected to be part of this, where they will take students from that particular area.
You're a good student.
Okay, got that. Now we charter schools. What do you have to be a charter school, and how is it different from a voucher school? And can you have a voucher school that's also a charter school?
No, although there are some cases where voucher schools have become charter schools and vice versa. I mean, a lot of people view charters as almost a public-private hybrid, and it can depend sort of how much it veers in the purely public versus purely private direction based on the state law, because each state has its own charter school law. And for instance, in Milwaukee, there are two different types of charters, broadly speaking. And at the ones that are under the auspices of the school district, there tends to be more oversight, and the teachers are all part of the teachers union. So in a lot of cases, the charter schools that are part of the Milwaukee Public Schools, I found, didn't differ a whole lot structurally from non-charter schools. In Louisiana and in New Orleans, the charter school teachers are not part of a teachers union, and they're overseen by – the charter schools are overseen by boards of directors. So they're fully publicly funded but essentially sort of privately or independently run. And they are subject to sort of open meetings laws that a typical school board would be, but they're not – it's not an elected board. So I would describe it as much more of a hybrid, as I said, than the voucher school.
And with what purpose? What's – if you're going to make a justification for why there should be a charter school, what kinds of problems do they deal with that?
I mean, since the beginning of the charter movement, I mean, the first charter schools opened in Minnesota in the early 1990s. And as with vouchers, you've seen sort of competing motivations. I mean, I think there were some progressive educators who supported charters at different points because they wanted to have more freedom and power over their curriculum. And you've seen progressive models like teacher cooperatives, where they don't have sort of the traditional hierarchical structure, emerge out of charters. And then you've also seen people on the flip side who view it as sort of privatization, and just fundamentally don't believe kind of that large urban districts should be run by elected school boards and think that they're bureaucratic and that structure is unsound. So depending on the place and the context, you just have all different kinds of motivations for charters, which is part of what makes it such a complicated thing to understand. And as with vouchers and traditional public schools, the quality just runs the gamut. I think most of the best research studies have shown that overall the performance is just as varied as traditional public schools.
How does homeschooling fit into this whole scheme of things?
Oh, my. Vouchers, homeschooling. Now you can ask about virtual schools.
That's right. One of my personal favorites.
Well, but I wanted to follow up a little bit on what Sarah said, because I think she did a very good outline of this sort of continuum of charter schools. And I just kind of wanted to bring it back here to Wisconsin, because we actually are seeing right here and now these different forces at work. I mean, right now Wisconsin has about 200 charter schools across the state that are approved and overseen by the locally elected school board. And in fact, I think we're about seventh in the country in terms of the number of our charter schools. But there also, as Sarah said, there's this competing force of charter schools that sort of chafe at public control and that are much more of a on that public private hybrid, much more in the private realm. And so one of the big issues in Wisconsin right now is that Walker has proposed as part of his budget, and some people are saying, well, this isn't really a budget question, it's a policy question, so it shouldn't be in the budget. But he's proposed what's called a charter school authorizing board. I think that might be the official name. And as opposed to, you know, school boards that are locally elected by the people in the community, this would be an appointed board, and it would be a statewide board. And given who would appoint the people at this point, it would be dominated by the Republicans, which, of course, it's then neck deep into partisan politics. But in Milwaukee, you know, one of the concerns I've had with the more privately run charters issued by the city is that the public oversight is almost non-existent. I mean, earlier this year, I called and or emailed, rather, every single city alderperson. All I wanted was a list of the city's charter schools. That's all I wanted, some basic information. Not a single alderperson had that list. Most of them weren't even sure where to get the list. A couple of them told me where to get the list, and the list was wrong. And but after about 2 days, I finally got a list of the city's charter schools, and I'm going like, what's going on here? I mean, if you don't even know what schools you're running,
are you really paying any
attention to what's going on?
And is it called charter school because they have presumably some kind of charter, some kind of plan,
they're basically granted a charter contract by their authorizer, and it might say, you know, we're giving you this charter contract for 5 years, and here are your goals. And the idea originally was that if they didn't fulfill their goals within a specific contract, they would be shut down. And you've seen, I mean, there are some places where underperforming charters have persisted indefinitely, and other places that have been much more aggressive in closing them down. But the charter basically came from this idea that an authorizer would grant a board of directors a charter to run a school.
And the measurement of success comes through test scores, or what else?
Largely. I mean, different states and places have various formula, and sometimes they'll factor in attendance and and graduation rates, but really it's a very standardized test score focused formula pretty much wherever you're talking about these days.
Even if you're talking public schools?
Well, I think unfortunately tests are now driving almost everything in public education. And, you know, I think there's some problems in that because, you know, we've really kind of stopped asking, what do we want our kids to learn? I mean, do we want kids to have art and music? Do we want kids to have a comprehensive curriculum? Do we want them to learn a second language? In Milwaukee this summer, we had to fight for a city ordinance saying that all schools in the city, and this mostly applied to charter and voucher schools because they're the only ones really on a growth spurt, that all schools in the city had to have a playground. And it seems like, okay, kids should have a playground. Mm-hmm. Well, the vouchers, people who were supporting and pushing the voucher movement, they opposed that legislation because they said, no, we need to keep the focus on test scores, and this will divert attention from test scores. And it was like, wait a minute here. You know, these are children. You know, like, please, dear God, don't tell me that we don't want our children not to have playgrounds.
Well, I do kind of remember when he was president, George Bush saying, you teach to the test. Was that quoted out of context?
Well, that's a favorite. I mean, that's the teach to the test terminology. I've heard it mostly from teachers who are saying, I'm a trained teacher. Different kids are different. What should I teach them? How should I teach them? And what they're saying is, I'm being told, no, teach to the test. That's all that really matters. And part of what happens is right now it's mostly English and math. So social studies, music, language, all these other curricular areas are being shrunk, literally, so people can focus on
tests. So if you could demonstrate that having a playground and teaching music and art actually enhances test scores, you'd have it made.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Louisiana, there's been also a growing shift to evaluate teachers based on their students' test score performance. And Louisiana debuted a system like that this year. And that does actually, there has to be measurements in place for art and music, and phys ed teachers have to show sort of demonstrable growth with their kids as well. And there's been a whole lot of criticism and concerns about how exactly that will play out and what it will mean for teachers in schools. But one of sort of the flip sides is that people are saying at least they'll take us seriously as art and music and stuff teachers, because now we're part of the measurement metrics that are so important to schools.
Although I always wonder what Emily Dickinson and Vincent van Gogh would do with a standardized test. You know, there's so many qualities that you cannot test for, or when people, you know, draw outside of the box, how does that get measured?
I've never seen a standardized test yet that can truly evaluate creativity,
ethics,
curiosity, you know, collaboration, determination.
Mm-hmm. Empathy.
It's a shame. Empathy.
Yeah. A lot of qualities that
well,
people...
you should be a teacher. Kindness is not a word you hear too often in schools these days.
Well, what about magnet school? That's another term that gets thrown out where my understanding of that would be it was a school where special programs, maybe bilingual stuff, extra science, things that would actually enhance the education would be added to that school so that it would attract people. But that was – is that within the public school system?
It was sort
system?
Of – as Barbara talked about mm-hmm. earlier, it was designed sort of to – when you had such housing segregation, people thought, well, you could have schools that don't have sort of the traditional neighborhood boundaries and limitations to them. And a lot of them emerged around a specific theme, as you mentioned, like arts or right. or sciences. And the idea was that kids would come across a broad area to them so that you'd be fostering more integrated school environments that way. But there has not been much mm-hmm. growth in magnet programs for a while. They really took off in the 70s and 80s as a way for districts to try and meet their goals under desegregation orders. But the emphasis has been much more on charter schools and voucher schools.
So it's kind of a dead idea.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have two daughters in their 20s and once in a while, I'll mention my fanny pack, and they'll go, oh, Mom, that is so 1980s, a fanny pack. And in a sense, you know, magnet schools are the fanny packs of education. No one talks about them anymore. Now, that's not to say you don't have citywide specialty schools in Milwaukee. We have mm-hmm. a very vibrant Montessori program. We have bilingual schools. We have dual language immersion schools. But they're not under the sort of magnet school sort of terminology anymore. That was really associated with the DSEG movement to try and have people voluntarily attend citywide desegregated schools.
When we return, we'll look at a few stories coming out of the schools of Milwaukee and New Orleans. Back in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Sarah Carr and Barbara Miner, and they have written books having to do with the phenomenon of urban schools in America today, with some background too. And in the case of Sarah, the book that she has written on the topic is Hope Against Hope, and Barbara has written Lessons from the Heartland. Their stories coming from New Orleans in the case of Hope Against Hope, and from Milwaukee in the case of Lessons from the Heartland. Barbara, in your book, you give a sort of the big picture, and it is hard, I think, as you have implied earlier in this conversation, it's hard to separate, or if you will, segregate, the idea of who goes to school where from the whole socioeconomic situation. Because in effect, if you're talking about school choice, it's money that buys you choice. Isn't that the bottom line?
Totally. And you know, one of the things in writing my book, you know, I went back to 1957. I started in 1957 because it's clear that you cannot understand what's happening today unless you go back and see the roots of a lot of this. And so I start in 1957 when the Milwaukee Braves defeated the New York Yankees and we won the World Series. You know, but equally important, you know, the factories were humming. The economy was strong and hopes were very high. You know, and one of the quotes that I like is Hank Aaron said, life did not get much better than Milwaukee in 1957. I end the book in the spring of 2011 with the protests here in Madison. And Wisconsin not only passed Act 10, but he cut public education funding more than any governor in Wisconsin history. And in Milwaukee, we went from this sort of happy days, Laverne and Shirley world to deindustrialization, poverty, just any number of problems. And so part of the reason I wrote the book and I went back to 1957, it was like, what happened in Milwaukee? You know, how did we get where we are today? Anyhow, before I'm going to end with a little story. Because people say, oh, my gosh, urban schools, you know, they kind of throw up their hands in despair. It's so depressing. And I always say to people, you know, if you really want to find hope, energy, and resilience, go visit a school. Because really, it's impossible not to be with young kids and not feel that energy and excitement and a sense of the future. So I'd like to read just a selection from the book. And this involves a young man who graduated from the Milwaukee Public Schools a few years ago. And today he's an activist in the fight for immigrant rights. So here I go. Dennis Rodriguez left Veracruz, Mexico in 2002. He was 11 years old and did not speak a word of English. More problematic, neither he, his mother, his father, nor his younger brother had legal papers. Rodriguez, with the confidence of youth, has decided he will not live in fear, and he refuses to hide his undocumented status. Fear is a mind killer, he says. Rodriguez didn't always feel that way. While at South Division High School, he and many of his friends thought there was little reason to do well academically because an undocumented person had little future. One day, however, he walked past a book sale sponsored by the school librarian. That book sale changed Rodriguez's life. Rodriguez was an avid reader, and his bilingual classes in middle and high school had allowed him to maintain his Spanish while learning English. I'm kind of nerdy, Rodriguez admits, so I was excited when I saw the book sale. I asked the librarian what would be good to read. She pointed to one book, explaining it was by a psychologist, Viktor Frankl, talking about his experiences during the Holocaust. I pick up Frankl's book, and underneath is a book with a bright orange cover and this guy with wild hair and big, darting eyes. The librarian said the book was by Nietzsche. She wasn't sure she should recommend it because she knew it was hard to read. But that cover was so eye-catching. The books were only a couple of dollars. Rodriguez bought them. It took me forever to get through the books, especially Nietzsche, he says. But they made me realize that I don't have to settle for what is here and now. I can build my own life. I mean, here's Frankl, this man who lost so much and went through so much suffering. Those books were a life changer.
So if we're looking at individuals, there's plenty, we suspect, based on that story, plenty of potential in the school system, whatever form it takes. But the whole trick is the structure. Is that what you think?
Well, and policy. I mean, I think one thing that people underestimate about the Milwaukee Public Schools is the bilingual program. I mean, I believe they're the only major district in the country that has what's called a maintenance program, where they specifically say we want bilingual programs where Spanish-dominant children can maintain and improve their Spanish while learning English. And Dennis is a great example of that.
And that's counter the way it has been done for many, many years, and the immigrant experience being that you come to this country and forget the language where you came from.
And have it stamped out of you sort of sometimes
with
deliberately.
With the English-only movement, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, Sarah, experiences from New Orleans?
Yeah, you know, I mean, New Orleans, it's sort of become this point of national debate sort of about charter schools and privatization and teachers unions since Katrina. After the flood, they swept most of the public schools into what's called the State Recovery School District with the intent of giving them to charter operators. So today, about 80% of the schools are charters, which is by far the highest percentage of any city in the country. And they also fired all of the teachers in the storm's wake, ending collective bargaining. And that sort of paved the way for a significant change in the teaching force in New Orleans and a rise in the number of teachers being recruited through alternative programs like Teach for America.
So teachers being brought in from outside, you mean?
Yes. Before Katrina, about 75% of the teachers were African American, and it really was sort of a source of middle-class income jobs for that community. And there's been a shift in that with a growth in the number of young white teachers coming from outside. You still have a number of schools that employ a lot of veterans who worked in the pre-Katrina schools, but not as many.
No, so now why the change?
that could keep us here for many, many hours. I think you know, I mean, as I said, there's different motivations that people have for all of these changes.
Right.
But I think
stated versus unstated.
I think a lot of sort of proponents of charter schools and people who were more skeptical of teachers' unions sort of did seize on this after Katrina to try and completely restructure an urban school district that they perceived as quote unquote failing. And by the test scores, it definitely was. I think as Barbara and I have talked about, there's a lot of complexity behind that label. But there's so much ideological debate about what happened in New Orleans with the schools that my attempt in writing this book was really to humanize the story and to show how it's playing out in people's lives and to try and shift away from some of the ideology. And so I followed a family at one school, particularly a young woman named Gerald Lynn, who's now 16 years old and was 14 when I first met her and began following her. I followed a young teacher at another charter school, and I followed a veteran principal at a third charter school. And my point was really to pick sort of people who had different life experiences and perspectives from each other and also from myself. And some things go really well. And if you read the book, some things go very poorly, I think, as they do in any kind of complicated urban school structure. But I think the main takeaway by the end of the book for me, which relates to sort of one of the points that Barbara is making, is that schools cannot be viewed in isolation, and that even if sort of these changes do succeed and the schools improve over time, you can't really revitalize a city through the schools alone, and that the approach to sort of poverty alleviation needs to be much more holistic. And if you have sort of a broken criminal justice system and a broken healthcare system and kids who are living in communities where there are high rates of gun violence and where their parents have to work 80 hours a week in service industry jobs to keep the family afloat, it's going to be very hard to have sort of transformative change, no matter how good the schools get.
And your title, Hope Against Hope?
You know, I like that title for a number of reasons. One of them, I think, is it sort of captured in subtly this tension over the direction that school reform should go in. But I also think it spoke to the fact that I think most people in New Orleans who I wrote about have the best of intentions. They don't agree in terms of the best way to get where everybody wants to get.
And then we just have a few minutes left. But what if you had the ear of all of Wisconsin legislators and Louisiana legislators, and also sort of at a national level, what do you think is the most important thing, the most important misconception that's out there about the schools, or the most important thing
a misconception. I don't know that I would target it specifically at policymakers, but just everyone. And that is that low-income families somehow don't care about education or aren't invested in their kids' education. I mean, the main family I followed, the mother literally did work 80 hours a week. She had to work as a hotel housekeeper and also in a restaurant to keep her family afloat. But she made sort of every parent meeting she could. She sort of constantly was talking to her kids about the importance of education. And I think a lot of people sort of mistakenly believe that part of the reason urban schools might struggle so much is that low-income parents aren't invested or don't care. And I really found that to be the opposite of the case.
Mm-hmm. And you, Barbara?
I have a lot of criticisms of public schools, but I firmly support and believe in the institution of public education, a commitment that I believe is fundamental. In fact, so fundamental, it's in the state constitution in every single state in this country. And I think people abandon our public schools at the risk of abandoning our democracy. And what I would say to the legislators, wow, I've never had anyone say, if you had Scott Walker in the legislator's ear, what I would say is, if you don't like what's going on in the public schools, fix them. Don't abandon them. And voucher schools are an abandonment of public education.
And we'll leave it at that note. And thank you for joining us, Barbara Miner and Sarah Carr.
Thanks for having us.
Providing insights that come from your long years of experience with public school systems in Milwaukee and in New Orleans in particular. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.